With the news in detail, here's Susan Jackson.
A Palestinian official in Gaza has said four people, including a pregnant woman, were killed in an overnight attack by the Israeli military. The official said they died in an airstrike on a house in the southern Gaza town of Deir al-Balah. The total number of Palestinians killed this month is now put at more than 800. Officials of non-governmental organizations put the number of Palestinian civilians killed at around 640. These, they say, include a large number of women and children. 32 Israeli soldiers and 3 civilians have died. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said he's shocked and appalled by the shelling of a UN school in northern Gaza where hundreds of Palestinian refugees were sheltering. At least 15 people were killed. Hamas blames Israel for the attack. Israel says it's trying to establish who is responsible. Speaking in Cairo last night, Mr. Ban said the actions of both sides were intolerable.
This is wrong. Why are you continuing to kill people? There are many other ways to resolve this issue without killing each other. I'm angry about what they are doing. But we have to take action now.
The Israeli government spokesperson, Mark Regev, says Israel does not target civilians.
It's not clear. At this stage, there were UN reports saying that Hamas was shooting rockets that were landing in the Beit Hanun area. So we can't exclude that possibility that it was Hamas rocket fire. It could also have been our fire because our forces were receiving fire from that area, from the immediate vicinity of the hospital. And it's possible that if our forces returned fire to that, that it could have been our fire as well. But we have to investigate exactly what happened.
The leader of Hamas, Khaled Meshaal, said people of Gaza were being punished with a slow death in what he described as the world's biggest prison.
Regardless of the mechanisms, what is important to me is there should be a genuine guarantee to lift the siege on Gaza. These promises have been made in the past, but nothing was done. Gaza is part of the Palestinian land. We have 1.8 million people. They need to live without a blockade. We want an airport, a port. We want to open up to the world. We don't want to be controlled by a border crossing that makes Gaza the biggest prison in the world.
There's been more fighting in Jerusalem and in the West Bank, where thousands of protesters clashed with Israeli security forces last night. Israel's security cabinet is expected to meet today to discuss truce proposals submitted to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by the US Secretary of State John Kerry at a meeting in Tel Aviv on Wednesday. President Obama has criticized US companies which are exploiting a legal loophole to reduce the taxes they pay. In an interview with CNBC, Mr. Obama mentioned Ireland as one of the locations being used by US companies seeking to reduce their tax bills. He said that while people were paid to maximize profits, they were also obliged to be responsible corporate citizens. Our Washington correspondent, Katrina Perry.
Barack Obama launched one of his strongest attacks to date on US companies with operations abroad who take advantage of more favourable tax conditions when he delivered a speech at the LA Technical Trade College yesterday. He said companies which did this were technically renouncing their American citizenship and could be described as corporate deserters. He said he intended closing a loophole in the American tax code which permitted companies to locate abroad, saying he didn't care if it was legal, it was wrong. In a follow-up interview with CNBC, he expanded on his comments, singling out Ireland as a country where US companies were locating to take advantage of a more favourable tax regime, as he said, by magically becoming an Irish company. This, he said, was gaming the system. US officials have said that limiting tax inversions would result in a saving to the US economy of $17 billion over 10 years. Katrina Perry, RTE News, Washington.
The wreckage of a plane that disappeared with 116 people on board on a flight from the West African country of Burkina Faso to Algeria has been found in Mali. Air traffic controllers lost contact with the plane operated by Algeria's national airline Air Algérie early yesterday after pilots reported severe storms. The passengers included 51 French citizens. A spokesman for the government of Burkina Faso, General Gilbert Diendere, confirmed that a search team had located the wreckage just over the border in Mali.
Cette mission a trouvé sur place The mission found pieces of the plane at the crash site. It also found, sadly, the remains of dead bodies. We were not able to evaluate the situation precisely as night began to fall, but the team did confirm that it had seen the remains of the plane, totally burnt out and scattered on the ground.
The Netherlands is sending 40 unarmed military police to eastern Ukraine to help find victims of MH17. Most of the bodies, but not all, have been recovered from the site. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said the Netherlands will also be sending investigators to the crash site.
I'm extremely motivated to find out what happened, who did this, and as soon as we know, I will do everything in my power, even if it's the last thing I do in this job, to make sure we bring them to justice.
The U.S. state of Arizona has halted executions pending a review of its death penalty procedures. The review was called after the execution by lethal injection of a convicted murderer, Joseph Wood, did not go as planned. Officials say Mr. Wood should have been dead 10 minutes after the lethal injection had been administered, but instead the execution took almost 2 hours to complete. Mr. Wood's lawyers are demanding an independent inquiry. And the time now is 7:30 past 8. The weather forecast, it'll be dry and sunny today. There'll be scattered showers in the west during the afternoon with heavy or thundery downpours. Highest temperatures will range from 22 to 27 degrees.
She's been reading since first light this morning, and Fiona Kelly's here now to tell us what it says in today's papers.
House prices, the German advisor who tells us we've no chance of exiting our bailout repayments early, and Star Wars comes to Skellig Michael are some of the stories you'll find in today's papers. Kenny denies bubble despite record surge in the price of homes. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Independent. While for its lead headline, the Irish Daily Mail predicts that house prices will be back to boom levels by 2019. Deja vu is a phrase which is used in two headlines over editorials related to this story today, in a piece by Connor Pope in The Times and in David McWilliam's column in The Independent, in which he talks about the herd mentality driving the property bubble and the number of cash buyers who are fueling it. The lead editorial in today's Independent also addresses the Taoiseach's comments. The politician in Mr. Kenny may welcome the short-term electoral benefits that will come his way if he continues to preside over a house price boom. The statesman should act now to halt an all-too-familiar scenario which could end up posing another death threat to our economy. The property bubble also features in the lead story in today's Irish Examiner and the business supplement in The Times. Speaking at a German-Irish chamber lunch in Dublin yesterday, Joachim Pfeiffer, an economics advisor to the German government, said that there is no chance of us getting a deal on the bailout. Mr. Pfeiffer told attendees, "It was your property bubble." The Times leads today with the attack on a UN shelter in Gaza yesterday. Ruan McCormack reports from Jerusalem on the paper's front page today, and also on an inside page from the Palestinian perspective in Ramallah. Elsewhere on the front pages, an unpatriotic tax loophole, that's how President Obama characterised the practice of American companies who relocate to countries such as Ireland to avail of favourable tax rates. That's on the front of the Times and Independent. 62-year-old former judge Heather Perrin is pictured out walking near her home in Malahide yesterday on the front of today's Irish Sun, following her release from the Dhocas prison in Mountjoy on Wednesday. Irish Daily Star and Herald both lead today with the tragic death of 13-year-old Gareth McGurk, who died swimming in a reservoir in Drogheda. 64 years of pain and still waiting for justice. That was the slogan on the placard carried by symphysiotomy survivor 92-year-old Margaret Dutton, pictured in front of today's Examiner, protesting outside Leinster House yesterday as the UN condemned Ireland's record on a number of human rights issues. A post-mortem is due to be carried out on a newborn baby in Cork City today after the mother of the infant presented herself to a Garda station yesterday. That's on the front of the Examiner, as is a story about how Cork woman Elber Toomey is to help Gardaí in their training to deal with suicidal people. Miss Toomey lost her husband Connie, her son Usheen and her unborn baby during a family holiday in Devon in 2012 when a taxi driver deliberately crashed into their car. Elsewhere this morning, all of today's papers report that a segment of the new Star Wars movie is to be shot at Skellig Michael over the course of 3 days from Monday of next week. And although the story hasn't been officially confirmed, the Examiner reports that Killarney businessman Declan Mulvaney has already produced the T-shirt Skellig Works 2014. Kerry also features as the poll topper in a myhome.ie survey of favourite counties to holiday in carried in today's Times. And the Times also reports today on another statistic that Ireland fell 6 places in the UN Human Development Ranking in 5 years. The Star reports that Dublin lawyer David Casserly, who is a world expert in sports law, has been hired by Luis Suarez to appeal his 9-match ban for biting. But finally, The Independent has a nice piece today about a dog called Thor, who was rescued from a dog-fighting ring in Cork last March with life-threatening injuries, which included a missing hind leg. The Dog Action Welfare Group in Cork took in the little terrier and nursed him back to good health until they found a loving new home for him locally with a woman called Dara Quinn, who also has another terrier called Andy, and an Angry Birds kennel, which used to be for her cat, but it has now become a new home for Thor.
Thank you very much, Fiona. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in Cairo this morning, hoping to make progress on securing a truce in Gaza. More than 800 Palestinians have been killed since Israel began its military offensive. 33 Israelis have died. Yesterday, at least 15 people were killed when a UN-run school was shelled. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that while he regretted each Palestinian civilian death, they were the responsibility of Hamas. Meanwhile, there's been criticism of the decision by Ireland to join other EU countries in abstaining from a UN vote on the conflict. The resolution before the UN Human Rights Council called for the setting up of an investigation into allegations of Israeli war crimes in Gaza. The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Charlie Flanagan, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
This abstention has stirred considerable anger, with Fianna Fáil's Éireann Power describing it as utterly shameful. Why did Ireland abstain?
Well, there were two issues involved here. Firstly, due to the urgency, we wanted a more swift and direct response to using existing and current structures to the appalling situation and the upsurge of violence resulting from this conflict. So there was the time issue involved that we didn't think it was appropriate to allow for a new and further investigation having regard to current existing UN structures. And secondly, with problems with the text. We wanted to include all violent acts on all sides, including Hamas and other militant groups in the region. We refer to the fact that the resolution failed to recognise the right of Israel as a democratic state in the region to defend itself. And we worked quite intensely all day long with and in partnership with our European colleagues and others to try and bring about a balanced resolution. That didn't prove possible. And there are times in the context of a 4- and 5-page document when it isn't possible to perfect the text in a way that we would thought.
You talk there about using the current structures, but isn't the problem at the moment that the normal approach isn't working? We saw that yesterday with the shelling of a UN school, something a senior UN official described to us earlier as a trend.
That's very true, and that's why I have clearly and consistently condemned the upsurge in violence. And on Tuesday, at the Foreign Affairs Council in Brussels, we played a very important and active role in ensuring that the European Union, with a voice of 28 states, in unison for the first time, condemning the very high level of casualty rate resulting from actions. And that is important in the context of ensuring that we're going forward firmly within the European Union and firmly within the UN. And there are times when we won't get all that we would like out of these discussions.
But are you getting anything at the moment? Isn't the EU being ignored?
What Ireland is doing, on the one hand bilaterally, and on the other hand through the UN and the EU, is doing everything in our power to ensure that we can halt this cycle of violence. Last week, I met with the Israeli ambassador. I conveyed to him in no uncertain terms the deep concern on the part of the Irish people at the appalling level of casualties in Gaza. Yesterday I had the opportunity of meeting face-to-face with representatives of the Arab League. I had a first-hand engagement with the Palestinian representative. I spoke to the Egyptian embassy. It's important that we, as a neutral country, with significant influence, do all we can in order to mould this process, because the absolute priority
is to end all violence. Do we have any influence at the moment? I mean, what would you say to those within the government who believed that the abstention was a mistake? For instance, Derek Nolan of the Labour Party says it was time for Ireland to use its own independent voice to express its own concerns, and his colleague Michael McCarthy said we have a moral duty to protect the most vulnerable.
We have, and I don't disagree with either of those, because we're continuing in Ireland to pursue a two-track approach. Firstly, from a humanitarian, an urgent point of view, that we're keeping the needs of the people of Gaza under continuous review. Earlier this week, we added a further €500,000 in terms of humanitarian aid to the not insubstantial €10 million a year assistance program that Ireland gives to the people of Gaza. This money earlier this week will go directly towards food, towards shelter, towards ensuring that the appalling losses can be in some small way dealt with. Also, on the political track, there's an urgent need for a ceasefire to allow the talking begin. I discussed this, as I said yesterday, with the Egyptian representatives, and if we can achieve this, this is only a stepping stone towards enduring what is the two-state solution. We have a recurring problem in Gaza every few years now, and you know, this crisis, however appalling that it is, it's not the first such crisis, and what we have to do is to hope that this is going to be the last one, and that the underlying issues which contribute to the violence can be dealt with.
But just again, on the current situation, you mentioned there a few moments ago that you spoke to the Israeli ambassador last week. Is it time maybe to call him in again?
I will contact the Israeli ambassador again today. I will continue to impress upon him the need to ensure that the deep sense of annoyance and grievance on the part of the Irish people is conveyed.
And but would you accept that many people who would normally be loath to criticise Israel have been appalled by what they've witnessed over the past couple of weeks?
That's true, but I believe it must be in the context of the right of Israel as a democratic state to defend itself and to defend its territory. But we in Ireland have to be clear-sighted here, because our voice, and this is important in the context of the EU foreign ministers meeting on Tuesday, which I attended, and the UN meeting in Geneva on Wednesday, our voice is stronger and our influence greater if we use it firmly within these institutions. There are times we won't get all we like in these discussions, but the best contribution that we can make is to ensure that both the EU and the UN are strong and effective players in adding our voice.
So you have no regrets then about the abstention the other day?
Situation.
You have no regrets about the abstention the other day? You still believe that was the right decision?
I believe that it was an opportunity lost, because the resolution, it could have been stronger, it could have been better, but we now have it. And, you know, we'll now move forward within the context of what we have. I was interested earlier this morning to hear UN Representative Robert Turner. When pressed on this particular point, he agreed fully with our stance that any UN resolution in the context of Geneva should have, and would in our view have been better, had it included reference to all violent acts on all sides, including Hamas and other militant groups who are causing real and serious problems in the area.
Just again on that point, I know you've spoken in the past about attitudes towards Israel and the Palestinians in this country. Indeed, you told the Sunday Independent last year that Israel had been demonised by an Irish media who were content to dance to the Palestinian drumbeat. Is that still your view?
Well, listen, this conflict is serving nobody's interests, and it needs to be brought to an end as speedily and as quickly as possible, and there needs to be accountability for what has occurred. And that's why we will continue to call for investigations into breaches of all humanitarian law. We will continue to be clear and consistent in our condemnation of violence resulting from this conflict and from whatever source. And this includes rockets fired by Hamas, and it also includes Israeli military violence. actions which have resulted in a huge and unacceptable level of civilian casualties.
And again, just to be clear on that, you mentioned the Israeli ambassador. You will be talking to him again today. Is that your intention?
I expect to speak to him this morning with particular reference to what happened yesterday in Gaza, which to my mind is utterly unacceptable. And I will be impressing upon him the need to ensure that Israel plays its part in bringing about an end to the unacceptable level of violence. We must remember, Rachel, last week I was very pleased, having had an opportunity of speaking to the Egyptian foreign minister. Egypt put forward a proposal for a ceasefire. It was accepted by Israel. Unfortunately and regrettably, it was rejected by Hamas. The Israel embassy assured to me yesterday at a meeting that proposal is still on the table.
All right. As you know, that was a contentious issue and there was a lot of disagreement about what was on offer and what wasn't on offer. But we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much indeed for taking our call this morning. That was the Foreign Affairs Minister, Charlie Flanagan. New figures from the Central Statistics Office, which were released yesterday, show that residential property prices have risen by 12.5% in the year to June, and prices in Dublin were up by almost 24% in the year. That's an extraordinary rise. But at a news conference in Dublin yesterday, the Taoiseach Enda Kenny rejected suggestions that Ireland was experiencing another property bubble, and he told reporters that plans were underway to increase housing supply.
Obviously, there's a significant increase in house prices in Dublin coming from a very low base where you had over a 50% decline. And that's driven by the law of supply and demand. Talking to estate agents and auctioneers, they say that people are walking into their premises with not one but two mortgages available in many cases, but no houses available. So they've got to get this moving. You're well aware that at the height of the boom, there were 90,000 houses being built annually in Ireland. Last year it was 8,900. So we've got to get that back up to 15, 20, 25,000 houses to deal with the demand that's there.
And that was Enda Kenny speaking yesterday. Earlier we spoke to Professor Brian Lucy of Trinity College about the current situation.
You know, technically this might not be a bubble because there are huge supply issues, as the Taoiseach has identified now. That means that when you've got very low supply and demand is rising, you'd expect to see prices rising. The thing is, though, that when you see a 25% year-on-year rise in house prices, that should absolutely terrify people. High house prices are not good for the economy. If we have learned nothing, and apparently we have learned nothing, then, you know, there's really no hope.
And that was Brian Lucy speaking earlier. So what efforts are being made to tackle the lack of housing in the capital in particular? With us is John O'Connor. He's chief executive of the National Housing Agency. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
First of all, what does the National Housing Agency do? Who are you?
We're an advisor to government in relation to housing. We particularly focus on public housing and on social housing, but on the general housing market, that's what we do.
Now, we know a lot at this stage about the situation in Dublin, and obviously yesterday there was some wrangling over use of language, but on the supply situation in the capital, what is being done to tackle the problem that's clearly there?
Yeah, from the analysis, you know, that the Housing Agency has carried out and others, we do need supply in Dublin and other parts of the country like Cork, Galway, Drogheda. In Dublin, we need to get up to supplying 7,500 to 8,000 per annum. The government is focused now in relation to increasing that housing supply. We have a construction strategy that set out a number of actions. There is now a housing supply task force in place in Dublin that which has identified sites that have got planning permission and can be developed immediately, and other sites that can be brought on stream.
But is anything actually happening at the moment? I mean, we have a strategy and a task force, but what about actual work?
In relation to it is going to take 18 months, 2 years to actually see much more development on the ground. NAMA have committed to providing land and capital to provide 4,500 homes. And I say the task force have identified sites that they're and identified key sites that they can push and encourage people to develop right now. There is a significant amount of also investment finance available to supply this housing. The one thing I would say that yeah, what we do need to do is get the supply right, and that once we do that, you know, and people see the supply coming through, that will help to dampen house price growth as people factor in the fact that, you know, future price expectations. So it's absolutely critical that we get to supply, and there's a lot of work being done on that.
This situation have been foreseen?
We were kind of, you know, dealing with the aftermath, you know, of the crash and the economic situation, and we're in a kind of a rebuilding mode. It has been, you know, clearly identified over the last couple of years that we need to get building again. And that's what the focus and the government at this stage is focused.
It sounds as though we were caught napping to a certain extent.
We were dealing with problems of unfinished housing developments. We were dealing with a lot of economic issues. And our first focus was actually in terms of dealing with the unfinished housing developments, get what we had built, get that finished, get what was completed into use. Now we have to get back, get our construction industry back to building. We also need to change our approach to housing. In the past, we had an over-focus on building to sell, making, you know, short-term profits. We do need to get more investment in housing. We need to get investment funds investing and on other investing in the sector.
More of an emphasis on family homes rather than on apartments?
Yes, there is need for family homes, but we also need to look at who we need to provide housing for. In terms of our analysis, that 25% of the housing stock is needed for single-person households, single people. Two-person households account for another 35%. So between the one-person, two-person households accounts for nearly 60% of the housing supply. So we need to focus on what household sizes we need to be providing. We do need family housing, but we need housing to rent, to buy. We need to be much more holistic in our approach to housing.
And just one other question then. You mentioned that sites had been identified. Where are these?
In Dublin, we have sites right around Dublin, from Stepaside to Sandyford, to West Dublin, Blanchestown, Ongar, Adamstown, then coming up Sword. There's a lot of development sites in Fingal available, Swords, and moving around to Baldoyle, Balgriffin. So there is a significant amount of land. The other thing I would like to add, in terms of the short term, we should focus also on utilising the existing vacant stock that's there, and get what we have into use while we're getting supply going.
All right, John O'Connor of the National Housing Agency, thank you for joining us.
Des is here at sport.
Yeah, good morning to you, Fran. Well, sometimes in sport, a defeat shouldn't mask an overall performance, and that certainly would apply to the Republic of Ireland under-19s women's team. They were beaten in the European Championship semi-finals last night. They lost 4-0 to the Netherlands in Oslo, which obviously was very disappointing. The Dutch will now face Spain in the final, but to keep it in context, Ireland have already beaten Spain and England and Sweden. It's been a great campaign. A top four finish in Europe is a fantastic achievement for the Irish girls, a fact reflected by coach Dave Connell.
We've had an absolute great tournament. I'm very, very proud of the players. We're obviously disappointed with the result tonight. But going forward, we've a lot of young players, and I think it's going to stand to them going forward. And hopefully we can get ourselves back into a finals next year, or as soon as we can, because I think it's great for the development of the players. But I think we've really brought an awful lot to this tournament, on and off the field. And the girls should really be proud of themselves, because I certainly am.
And how right he is. In the Europa League, Derry City, Dundalk and Sligo Rovers all bowed out. Although Dundalk had a famous 2-1 victory away to Hajduk Split, goals from Pat Hoban and Curtis Byrne gave Dundalk a 2-1 win in Croatia, but they were eliminated 3-2 on aggregate, having lost at home. Derry were beaten 5-1 away by Shakhtar Soligorsk in Belarus. Michael Duffy scored an early goal for the Candy Stripes, but they lost 6-1 on aggregate. For Sligo, there was absolute heartbreak. When Danny North scored first at the showgrounds, they then led Rosenberg 3-1 on aggregate, but the Norwegians came back to score three goals and win 4-3 on aggregate. Adrian Eames got the reaction of Sligo's Gary Rogers.
We're very disappointed, because it was a game that, we had good chances and they didn't create that many chances. I think they capitalised on our mistakes, and unfortunately these teams of this quality will punish you, and it's a pity we didn't see it out, because I think, you know, over the two legs our the work we put in probably deserved it, but you don't always get what you deserve in this game.
And having kept them at bay early on, in fact you took the game to them, got the lead goal after 13 minutes, and obviously the place erupted, but then to concede so quickly afterwards, that was a bit of a body blow.
Absolutely, look, we were hoping to keep it, you know, clean sheet until half time at least, and really put the pressure on them. That would have asked serious questions, and it's a pity after scoring the goal, you know, for them to, you know, score straight away is very disappointing. But like, even at that, we still had good opportunities, and you know, we should have probably just the scoring straight after half time, which to be honest with you was a very lucky goal, because when I seen it coming out, it came off the side of his boot, like he's absolutely fluked it in and went into the top corner, and that's the sort of bit of luck that we didn't get tonight.
Now, as a result of those European games, there are just two matches tonight in the Premier Division. Cork City go to Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers host Drogheda. Luis Suarez could make his Barcelona debut against Real Madrid in the first El Clasico of the season, following the release of this season's La Liga fixtures. By sheer coincidence, they have fixed the match for Barcelona and Real Madrid the day after Suarez's ban ends. So talk about getting them back in a blaze of publicity.
Times ahead.
Yes. In cycling, Vincenzo Nibali claimed his fourth stage success of this year's Tour de France. So he's almost certain of victory now. There's only three stages to go. No huge trouble in them. And he has a lead of 7 minutes and 10 seconds. On to Gaelic games, and ahead of Sunday's All-Ireland Hurling quarterfinals, both Limerick and Tipperary have named unchanged teams. We're going to look ahead to those games now with Michael Dygan. Morning, Michael.
Morning, Des.
It'll be a great occasion. Wexford-Limerick, there's this huge buzz going in Wexford now. How will they get on against Limerick?
Well, there is massive hype in Wexford, but I think also in Limerick, they have huge support. You know, they brought 20,000 to the Tipperary game with a massive crowd in Cork as well. So, you know, as you mentioned, there are 46,500 in Turles on Sunday. The atmosphere is going to be unbelievable, and I suppose whoever handles the pressure is going to be, you know, Limerick haven't won Northern Ireland since 73, obviously Wexford since 68, so when they get closer then to the goal of winning the All Ireland, I think the pressure mounts on them. I just love the way Wexford have been playing over the last number of weeks. There's a lot of talk about them you know, getting on a roll, but I think the quality of the hurling has improved game on game, and if they can cut out the bad rides that they had, I think they will do it. And Limerick will look at it the same way. Against Cork, they were brilliant in the first 20 minutes. They really should have been 6 or 7 points up, but they weren't. They left Cork in the game, and Cork gained the confidence and pulled away in the second half. But they also played very well. They had a lot of things to work on since then. So I'm expecting a very, very tight battle, a great game with a great atmosphere, but I'm tipping Wexford to just get through in that one.
Okay, I don't want to be picky with you, but you said Wexford haven't won since 68.
Oh,
but
sorry, 96, yeah, they'll kill me.
Didn't they beat you on the way, did they? Get over
obviously
it, Michael.
Obviously tried to wipe that
I'm definitely losing it.
The other game sees Tipperary against Dublin, and Dublin underperformed big time in the Leinster final.
They did, and you know, I'm firmly in the camp of someone who believes that was a blip on the day. You know, they're not. I think Dublin this year came into the championship with a great chance. I think they've won their Leinster championship, they've won their league under Anthony Daly, and the only thing left was not Ireland. And I'm not saying they went out in the Leinster final not to win it, but certainly to me, you know, that's not the true Dublin. I think there's an awful lot more in them. We saw them beating Wexford in Wexford Park. I was down there that night. They did that very professionally. So I'd be putting Leinster final form behind Dublin, away from them. I don't think that's going to count. I think Tipperary, you know, they needed a shot in the arm. They were going along. Their supporters weren't really getting behind them. There was no great confidence in the camp. But then against Galway, 6 points down, they looked like they were heading out of the championship. And next thing, they started to play like they can. They have a brilliant forward line. I think the former John O'Dwyer, Noel McGrath, Seamus Callan and Bonner Maher, and of course Lara Corbett coming back to his best form as well over the last number of weeks. So look, at Tipperary are on, you know, they're on fire up front. They're going to put up a huge score, and Dublin, you know, will they be able to score as much as Tip? I don't think they will be able to, but I'm expecting a massive battle from Anthony Daly's men. But I think Tipperary at home in Turles, it's, you know, it's their home pitch. I think that's going to get them over the line in a high scoring match, and I expect, as I say, Dublin to put up a huge performance in that one.
All right, Michael Dygan, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Day two of the Russian Open golf is underway, and the overnight leader, David Horsey, has dropped a shot early on to fall back to 6 under par. Damien McGrain and Kevin Phelan are 3 under after round one. In the Canadian Open, Graham McDowell is 4 shots off the lead. He shot 2 under par, 68. And day two of the British Seniors Open in Wales, Bernhard Langer leads on 6 under par, Philip Walton and Des Smith on 1 over. Northern Ireland won its first medal at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. Lisa Kearney from Belfast taking bronze. bronze in judo. In racing, Jack Naylor was a surprise winner of the Group 3 Silver Flash Stakes at Leopardstown for Jessica Harrington and jockey Fran Berry. Aidan and Joseph O'Brien teamed up to land the other Group 3 race, the Tyra Stakes, with the favourite Glen Eagles. And we have two race meetings this evening at Wexford and Down Royal.
Des, thank you for that. So we've already heard about UN shelters coming under attack from Israeli forces. It's now a trend in Israeli army operations, the Relief and Works Agency told this programme earlier. We've also heard about the killing of a pregnant 23-year-old woman in overnight airstrikes. The death toll in Gaza now above 800 people, 80% of them civilians on the Israeli side, 32 dead, all but two were soldiers. Tensions are growing in the West Bank too, with thousands of people marching on the streets in protest over what's happening in Gaza. Two people died there last night. Amidst all of that, hospitals with limited supplies and in some cases bombed buildings are trying to treat the hundreds of injured who are pouring into their facilities in Gaza every day. Dr. Mahmoud Dahar is working with the World Health Organization in Gaza and is on the line. Good morning, Dr. Dahar.
Good morning, sir.
We're seeing images daily from the hospitals on our television screens now. How are health services coping?
Well, very much difficult. As you mentioned, hundreds of people are coming on a daily basis to hospitals, injured and killed because out of the bombardments that are taking place. Houses have been destroyed over families, and civilians are involved in this conflict and war. There have been more than half or more than one third of the killed were children, and another third were women. The incident of yesterday, shooting and bombardment over a shelter, a school of where refugees and IDPs were seeking a safe place to go to, took the life of at least 13 people, two children and six women out of them. One of the hospitals that I visited 3 days ago was shelled by the Israeli artillery and air missiles, causing the death of two staff members in addition to other companions in the hospitals and injuring other staff members. There have been another damages to at least 18 health centers and killing of many health staff. As you mentioned, the involvement of the rescue teams in this and the attack to them causes a very big problem in Shifa Hospital, which is the biggest hospital in Gaza. People are panicked there.
What about the practical difficulties as doctors in trying to treat people? What are the issues, what are the shortages you're having to deal with?
Well, at this moment, there are shortages of many supplies. There are many attempts to improve this situation by bringing kits from outside Gaza, but the consumption is increasing more and more, and the supplies that are coming into Gaza are not up to the expectations. The people are improvising in many of the occasions. They are putting or they are using the single-used stuff in many surgeries and in many interventions. They are repeating the use of these single-use consumables. In many occasions also, they do not find the sutures, the suitable sutures, and they just use other types in order just to save lives. This issue is posing a big difficulty. The staff themselves are very much exhausted, and they are day and night working in the hospital without having a possibility to leave, to reach their families. In many of the occasions, people cannot reach the hospital because of the security conditions.
Is there a reality, doctor, is there a reality that if you had optimum conditions, usual conditions, are there people dying because of how tough things are, because of the shortages and the sort of issues that you're raising?
Well, shortages were already before this military operation. 30% of the drugs were out of stock, and 50% of the drugs were of the consumables were out of stock, and that pushed the healthcare system to send people outside Gaza. 16,000 people a year is going outside. At this moment, they cannot go in this capacity because of the security conditions. We are not there are no evidence if people are dying or not because of the lack of drugs and supplies. We need to explore this after the situation become calmer.
Should some consideration be given to evacuating some people who need treatment that just can't be provided to them?
Well, yes, this has happened. The health authorities in Gaza evacuated people to East Jerusalem hospitals, to Jordan and to Egypt. So evacuation is happening in order to allow more space for newcomers to occupy the beds.
Can I ask you, Dr. Maher, about your own family? Because we spoke to you a number of days ago and you said that you had had to leave your home with your wife and your children. How are things now?
Well, things are worse in my place. I had to leave 16 days ago. My house was damaged because of the bombardment in the vicinity of my house. They bombarded two or three houses after I left the house, and I couldn't reach there in order to check on. We are ourselves, my family and myself, are displaced and trying to seek a safer place. Still, the situation the same.
What sort of practical difficulties is that causing people, in particular medical staff, who are, as you say, are working around the clock as things stand?
Well, that causes a lot of difficulties. From one side, they need to work and save lives, and from the other side, they have their concern over their family. I had a story of one of the rescue teams who was volunteering in the ambulance, and when he went to see one of the places affected and evacuate people, they brought him to his own house, and unfortunately two members of his family were among the people who were killed. Another rescue team member, when he evacuated people to the emergency services, he discovered that his two of his family members were among the people who were killed. That is affecting dramatically the moral and the psychological status of these people that are rescuing others, and they are themselves are affected.
All right. Thank you for speaking to us this morning. That's Dr. Mahmoud Daher, who works with the World Health Organization in Gaza. Welcome back to the programme. To some breaking news now. Two people have been killed in a road accident in County Laois this morning. Our Midlands correspondent, Kieran Mullooly, is on the line. Kieran, what can you tell us?
Fran, this accident happened just after 6 o'clock this morning on the main Stradbally to Carlow Road near the village of Arliss in County Laois. Gardaí are saying a motorbike with two people on board was in a collision with a van on a bad stretch of road near Simmons Mill Crossroads. Now, two people have died at the scene, and I understand there are other injuries and the emergency services are still in the area. This stretch of road between Stradbally and Carlow is a difficult stretch of road. At the best of times, it's quite a windy stretch of road. It's a national secondary route, and it's a very, very busy artery between the Midlands and the South. And I'm afraid this morning it has been the scene of a terrible tragedy. There is considerable traffic disruption, and the Gardaí are asking people at this point to avoid the N80 between Stradbally and Carlow because diversions are now in place.
All right, Kieran Mullooly, thank you for that. More good news to finish. It's been the hottest week so far this year in Ireland, with temperatures as high as 28 degrees in some places. People have flocked to beaches and parks to enjoy the sunshine, while some farmers are out in force for maybe their second or even their third cut of silage. Morning Ireland's Jackie Fox went out to see how people are enjoying their summer so far.
For the day, and myself and my daughter Kira are making a big castle with a moat around it and filling it up with water, and the water is running right down to the sea now.
Yeah, 42 years old catching a mermaid, I'd sit waiting for one.
I caught one about that the other day.
The first thing I'd like to do is get out of my apartment and out in the outdoors. Just come and sit by the pier and read my book and watch people. It's a great way to spend the summer evening.
And I see you have the hurls out today. Were you out playing here?
They were, yeah. They were playing down for the down on the beach, keeping away from the crowd that you don't hurt somebody anyway. They're not bad. They're from Kildare though, so they haven't much hope.
We've been in the water and playing with the sand. It wasn't scary because we went into it on Monday as well.
I know how to
swim in my other swimming lessons too, but my brother told me how to do it in there. Sometimes all the salty water goes up my nose.
How much fun, but we don't want to go back to school.
Okay, you're ready? Here, oi.
Been fishing here since we're kids, like, you know what I mean? Myself and my brothers and that, you know what I mean? All my mates, like, so much. So I'd say I'm probably fishing here about 30 odd years. But we're just fishing for mackerel at the moment, so this kind of weather is actually better for mackerel fishing, you know what I mean? Like.
And have you caught any?
No. Nothing today. There is a few getting caught, but we haven't caught any, so.
Dixon Finn, Avoca County Wicklow, cutting silage here, Strathmore, Avoca, 28 degrees. This field here was actually mowed this morning. On a normal year, you probably just pick it up the following day, but today we have an exceptional day here today. The grass is beginning to wilt already, so here we are at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we can start picking it up already. As you can see, like, you have a good mixture there, there's grass with some sap in it, it's totally dry on top, which is great. It's ideal feeding for cows, for milking cows. It is an exceptional year. It's been an easy year on machinery. It's been a great year for animals. Animals like the heat. From the GAA point of view, we were caught on one or two nights there where it was hard to get guys to play because they're off driving tractors, we say, cutting silage and different things. Like I say, there's a saying in the country, you make hay when the sun shines, and That's what we're at.
Can I £2.99, please?
Yeah, it's €5, please.
It's actually broken.
Did you hear that?
What was that?
Most of us picture a dinosaur, we picture a large, scaly creature, but new research suggests that all dinosaurs had the potential to grow feathers. This follows the discovery at a fossil site in eastern Siberia of a new species of dinosaur. Dr. Maria McNamara, who's a lecturer in geology at UCC's School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences, was involved in that research, and she joins us from our Cork studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the name of this new species because it's quite a tongue twister.
Calindodromius.
Right, tell us about him.
Well, Calindodromius means fast runner from Calinda. Calinda is the name of the fossil site. And, what we know about Calindodromius is that it was a small plant eater, about 1 metre long, had a short little snout, a long hind limbs, short forelimbs with 5 strong fingers. It was a plant eater based on the structure of the teeth, and most intriguingly, it was covered in feathers. And this is a really important find because, you know, one of the biggest debates in paleontology for the past, you know, 15, 20 years has been, how did feathers evolve? And up until now, all dinosaurs which have been found with feathers, they've all been very advanced meat-eating dinosaurs from a group that are very closely related to modern birds. So the fact that they had feathers wasn't very surprising. But our little Calindodromius from Siberia, it's a really primitive dinosaur. It's right at the bottom of the dinosaur evolutionary tree. And yet, even though it's so primitive, it has complex feathers that are very similar to those that we see in modern birds.
You've been studying these feathers.
I was called in to help study the feathers about a year ago, because after the specimens were initially found in Russia, initially just a whole pile of bones were discovered. And so after the Russians did some extra field work, work and realised that they had dinosaur bones. A colleague of mine, Pascal Godfroy from Belgium, got involved. He's a dinosaur expert. And once he realised that this black coaly material beside the bones was soft tissue, was probably feathers, he asked me to get involved along with Professor Mike Benton from Bristol, because the two of us, myself and Mike, have a lot of experience in working with preserved fossil tissues and especially feathers.
It sounds like very exciting work.
It is. You know, when I first saw the specimens, my initial reaction was, well, I didn't believe it, because, you know, surely these primitive dinosaurs shouldn't have such complex feathers. So the first real task was to try and convince ourselves as scientists that what we were looking at were indeed feathers. And there was quite a bit of debate among the scientists in the group, but eventually we found the evidence we needed. We found these branched feathers that are joined together at the base, and we know that these branched feathers were fairly flexible because you can see they wiggle along their length, so they must have been fairly soft and flexible if they were able to bend along their length. So we know we're dealing with soft down-like feathers.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning to tell us about it. That was Dr. Maria McNamara there from UCC.
So this is what's known as the Leviathan from Burr, which is a 6-foot telescope. As you can see, it's quite a monster, the size of most people's houses plus. What you see is a very large tube, and the tube is pointed at the sky, and it's on the north-south meridian.
The reflecting telescope at Burr Castle remains one of the world's largest historic scientific instruments still working today. When it was built by the 3rd Earl of Ross, William Parsons, the estate became a global hub of discovery and science. Lady Alicia Clemens, formerly Parsons, is a direct descendant.
The Parsonses came here in 1620. We originally came to Yule as pirates and eventually made our way up the Shannon to the Midlands. We've been here for 14 generations. Well, in the 1850s, you had a wonderful group of people that came together. You had the 3rd Earl of Ross and his wife, Mary Field, and her cousin, Mary Ward, and their children, who were all educated at home. As astronomers, they had to be engineers, because you didn't go online and just order the best telescope at the time. You had to build it from scratch, and there were all sorts of inventions, such as how do you make a 3-ton metal mirror? How do you cool it? How do you polish it? How do you get the right curvature? All of these things had never been done on that scale before, so numerous inventions had to be overcome, invented.
The generation of Parsons that followed was just as creative. Charles Parsons is best known for inventing the steam turbine.
As a child, he had numerous other discoveries and inventions. He invented a steam-propelled car well before anybody else had done such things. Sadly, their cousin Mary Ward fell off the front of the car and died, and therefore, out of a fit of complete sadness, he went and took a sledgehammer to his steam-propelled vehicle. If not for that, we might have had Ford Motors or Parsons Motors in Burr. But there we go. We realise we have a beautiful garden and a lot of history, but we also realise, me as a mother of young twins, that you need something for the children. And so we built this last year, this treehouse play area. Yes, it's definitely Ireland's largest treehouse.
These days, Burr Castle is best known for its gardens, with botany having become the science of choice over the last century. Astronomy takes centre stage once again, though, in a new gallery officially opening at the castle today.
Burr now has a radio telescope, which no one really knows about. That radio telescope is looking out into the space and recording all sorts of data, which is going straight to the Irish universities. And here behind you, we will have a live link of it and solar flares and what it's seeing. This is, to me, the most moving of all of it. This is about Mary Ross, who was an heiress, a wife, a mother, an inventor, everything.
The new gallery doesn't just remember the achievements of the male heirs. In the earliest days of photographic development, Mary Parsons, wife of the 3rd Earl of Ross, was at the very forefront.
This is the oldest surviving darkroom in the world. This is Mary Ross's darkroom. So in the 1980s, we discovered it in a tower, and it had all the original chemicals, all the original cameras, a lot of the plates, everything as was that you would need for an 1850s to 1880s darkroom. So many discoveries were made here for such a long period of time. We've got all three of my generation living and sharing the estate here, and what we all long to do is kind of share it with everybody else. We're very proud of what the family have achieved, and we'd love everyone to kind of go, yes, this was an Irish achievement, we're proud of it too.